I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half, the New Statesman's Culture Podcast. I'm Tom.
And I'm Kate.
And we've just entered the podcast room in the wake of Jason Cowley, our editor, hosting an emergency version of his football podcast. And I can feel some of that still in the air.
It's close. It's moist.
I'm trying to channel some of that incisive sporting commentary.
Yeah.
I think we need to bring some of that into our own podcast.
I watched, it was the first match I ever watched, I think, last night.
Do you mean?
Ever.
Of the
first football.
The first match of football you have ever watched ever.
And I found it quite boring. And I was also frustrated by the fact that there are lots of Croatians writhing around on the floor clutching their shins, which apparently is completely legal in order to waste time.
Well, the shin is a very sensitive area. And I can, one fact I know about football is that they wear shin pads to protect their shins.
So this is just proof that it was made up. They had shin pads on. But presumably they can't just like roll around clutching their shins from the start of the game. It has to be when they've got a little bit of time left and they don't want someone else to score.
I think that would be a different sort of game if the entirety of the action was kind of carried out just by rolling around clutching your shins. I can imagine that game. You'd have to sort of nudge the ball forward with your body.
Also, the other thing I noticed from the football match, the singing is constant. Even when tension is high and things are happening, they're still managing to sing songs up in the gods. And I just find that really strange. Like, how come they're focusing on their tunes and their lyrics when they're watching people losing and winning?
Well, isn't the point of a football anthem, though, that you don't need to think too hard about the words?
It wasn't the Atomic Kitten one, was it? That's quite difficult.
What were they singing?
I don't know. I heard the generalised roar.
And then I think they were doing Don't Look Back in Anger afterwards.
Oh, maybe that was what I heard. Anyway.
But
did you enjoy it?
I did enjoy it, yeah. When it looked like it was going into extra time, this is football Croatia we're talking about. England, Croatia. We really need to stop now. I had an idea, which is instead of penalties, if it had gone to that stage, instead of penalties, they should just clear all the players off the pitch and just the goalies just boot it.
Oh, yes.
Just try and score.
A long distance shooting.
And it would go on, it could go on for a maximum of 6 hours. And eventually they'd get so exhausted that someone would make a mistake and let one in.
That's a brilliant idea.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
You're welcome, FIFA. What are we going to be talking about today?
We're talking about the fantastic musical Fun Home, which has come to the Young Vic.
Excellent. And I think we're going to give you some summer listening tips.
Summer Sounds, the new album from Let's Eat Grandma, and a strange new collaboration between Underworld and Iggy Pop. And we'll also have the millionth of our non-iversaries, the non-specific event in culture. So, Tom, you know this, you're already familiar with this family tragicomic, as it's called, by Alison Bechtel, Fun Home. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I love that description, actually. I think it's weirdly accurate. It is a tragicomic. Alison Bechtel is a cartoonist, comics artist, and Fun Home is a memoir in sort of graphic novel form that came out in 2006. And I remember it well. I was working at the Times, and Erica Wagner, who was the literary editor at the Times, we both came across this book and were just knocked out by it. It's very literary, actually. It's very written. She's got a beautiful drawing style, but it's also very, very literary, very densely written, lots of references. And it is the story, it's her own story. It's the story of her father, Bruce Bechtel, who was gay, and Alison Bechtel, just as Alison Bechtel came out when she was at university, she discovered that her father was gay and had been having various, both failed and successful affairs with young men over the years. And then quite soon after she makes this discovery, he dies. He's hit by a truck, and she thinks it's almost certainly suicide. So the book is her attempt to kind of unravel all these different threads. The backdrop is amazing in that Bruce Bechtel is a English teacher, but he also runs the local funeral home.
He does everything, doesn't he?
He restores houses. He's such a fascinating character. But yeah, the title of the book, Fun Home, is the family sort of nickname for the funeral home.
Why did he do all those things? He could have just been an English teacher. That's what's strange. Maybe he was just so manically obsessed with work that he needed to have a funeral home on the side and be an English teacher and be restoring houses.
Yeah, I think the funeral home was a family sort of obligation in that he took it over from his father or grandfather. But he throws himself into all these different aspects of his life and pursues them, each of them, apart from English teaching, which he doesn't seem to
bothered really talk about that. Although he sends her books all the time,
yeah,
doesn't
he? Yeah, he's got a passion for reading and a passion for literature.
And a passion for young men in his class.
Yeah, but he pursues all of these strands with kind of monomaniacal intensity, doesn't he? Like when he's decided that he needs to go out and find someone, he kind of does it to the point of doing really stupid things like giving beers to young guys in his car, which gets him caught.
Chilling moments like, my house is back there, sir. Yes, I know. I just wanted to get to know you better. And I think this is sort of so borderline. She was approached to write for a film about this a few years ago. And she said an interesting thing that she thought almost that a film would linger around too long if it was a bad film. Mm. Whereas a stage musical, if it was really bad, would just tank and no one would talk about it again. So in a sense, she was kind of hedging her bets with allowing it to be put on stage. It makes me think about the role of musicals nowadays, because this is within that vogue for musicals about extremely dark subjects. Urinetown and, you know, that one committee that was on at the Donmar recently, which was all about the kids' company scandal. Mm. And it seems to be a very sort of interesting age for musicals, because in the old days you had the ones where the music was obviously the focus, the great Rodgers and Hammersteins. And then you had the ones which were the jukebox musicals, where there was a terrible story stitched together around the big songs by Queen or whatever. And then this is very different, isn't it? I mean, the music is not a big part of this, even though it's a musical. It carries something. It carries the energy along, but it's not necessarily that you come out singing songs from it.
And why did they conceive this as a musical? Why not adapt it? I mean, I'm glad that they did, because oddly it works very well, but it seems like setting yourself an enormously difficult task. I mean, I just wonder if there's something about the fact that the original was this graphic novel, so you've got a verbal element, but then the pictures push it into a kind of third dimension, whether the songs kind of occupy a similar function in this, in that they enable you to be doing two things at once.
It's very weird. It's a very subtle appeal that these dark musicals have. And it is something about the kind of slight irony there. Mm. Let's look at this ridiculously dark subject with this kind of jazz hands kind of thing.
Well, it allows them to do a couple of really, you talk about jazz hands, but there's a couple of really fun songs in here. And there are comic moments in the memoir, but there's nothing quite as all out joyous as, for example, in the musical, there's a scene where the kids are like, performing they've made up a commercial for the funeral home, and it's this brilliant sort of
1970s
it's like a Jackson 5
disco
backing,
yeah
like a great disco backing, and they're like popping out of coffins, they've got like They got really nicely choreographed little dance routines. And
this is an aneurysm hook is one of the lines, things like that, formaldehyde, all that. Yeah.
And it works brilliantly well. So it allows them to do things like that.
It must be something to do that. The other thing that I thought was Zubin Vala is the guy who plays Bruce, the father. There's a completely uncanny resemblance between him and the pictures in the original graphic novel.
Mm.
And I wasn't overwhelmed by him as an actor, but I was thinking afterwards, maybe that was all deliberate as well, because it is a graphic novel. In your mind, if you liked it, it is strongly associated with the picture of this guy that already existed that she drew. Therefore, it's important to get someone who is almost a carbon copy of him on the stage. And that's unusual, because technically you could adapt anybody. You could have anyone in your mind's eye.
Yes, and I think I know you didn't look at the book until after seeing the stage musical, but from my point of view and talking to other people who'd read the book before, it's uncanny how Zubin Vala does kind of replicate exactly what I had in my mind as the character of Bruce Bechtel. The combination of kind of chilling aggression and anger and sort of passion and occasionally sort of generous passion as well. The way that he's kind of in some ways really good with the kids and spends a lot of time with them, and then in other ways is just, you know, there's a really there's a scene which does sort of feature in the book, but they've really fleshed it out for the musical, in which the young Alison is drawing a picture for her homework, and she's doing a map of the local area, and he starts saying, oh no, look, this is what you want to do. And it's kind of quite funny. It's like kind of competitive dad, you know. And then he gradually just takes it over until he's completely pushed her out of it and saying, you know, you don't want to embarrass yourself in front of the whole class. If you do it your way, it's going to be crap. And at the end, she's completely sort of cowed by that and kind of just wants his approval.
But what's interesting about that is that's like a monster parent in one sense, but her mother, played by Jenna Russell, is totally detached. So which is better? You know, Jenna Russell is practicing the piano and Alison's hanging out there and she goes, go away, you're annoying me, you're disturbing me. When medium Alison, the teenage one, the college student, comes out, she does so in a letter that she sends back to her parents. And the mother never responds to the letter. And she's, Dad, what did Mum say? What did Mum say? So in a sense, you can see the seductive power of that parent that's a great educator and is also unpredictable. And that's why he figures so large in her life compared to her mother in the early years of it.
Yes. One of the adapters said that this piece made sense to them when they saw it not as adapting a graphic novel into a musical. But what's the quote? This wasn't putting the book on stage. It was telling the story of how we continue to reach for our parents at every age. Mm. And one, as always, we like to not communicate a key fact about something. And the key fact that we've neglected to communicate, although you hinted it there, was that Alison is played by three different actors in the... So we've got the child, we've got the sort of college age Alison, and then we've got the adult who's the one basically narrating the story, and as with the dad, bears an uncanny resemblance to Alison Bechtel, or at least how Alison Bechtel draws herself in the graphic novel.
And there's a resemblance between father and daughter when they're sitting next to each other in the car.
And she, what they've decided to do in this is not to kind of try, I mean, I was reading about, because this has a long this is a long history, this production. They started working at it in kind of 2009, I think. And then there were various off-Broadway productions, the Public Theatre's Public Lab in 2012. And in early iterations of the show, they were very much like trying to do stuff with like drawing and cartooning, like incorporating all of that. And they've stripped that out completely, apart from the fact that the grown-up Alison, when she's describing scenes, occasionally says caption, and
she is sketching whole time. She's at her drawing desk, standing up desk.
Yeah. So it's still, they haven't erased it completely. You're right, but they haven't tried to represent it visually in any way.
I think they really did some interesting things with the visuals, though, in another sense, because the home that they live in is this, they refer to it as a museum.
Oh, yeah.
Everything is, it's always polishing silver and finding bits of junk and turning them into artifacts and perfect floorboards and this kind of thing. And for the first part of the play, it's very much represented by the odd thing here and there. So there's a silver jug, or there's like a coffee table with some books on it. And then for some amazing reason, very close to the end, on one of the final scenes, the backdrop falls and an incredible 3D stage appears that's completely decked out like this home that they live in. And I just love that. A strange decision to not use the space that they had and they could have been using from the beginning, but just to put it in right at the end. Mm. And you look at this wonderful, it's almost like a cabinet of curiosities. The entire house that she's been describing all the way along is suddenly visible to you. And I wondered if that's something to do with the sense of memory that the thing plays with. You know, she's trying to piece together, what was he actually like? What was it like when I was 11? And then as she gets closer to her current age, bam, there it is. There's the whole house.
I think you're totally right. I think that I like that because, and I wasn't going to say this because I thought it was slightly pretentious, but I like that because it gave a sense of her like slowly accumulating the detail as she's like trying to work this thing out.
Yeah.
And then by the end of it, as with the graphic novel, she's got this really rich picture and it's all there. And she talks about in the stage show, she talks about like needing these objects, like being obsessed with kind of having the real things to draw it so that she can recapture the reality. When I was at the Times, as I mentioned before, we picked this the original book as one of our books of the year, and I did an interview with Alison Bechtel just over email, but she was really interesting. And one of the things she talked about was how the book took her 7 years to put together, and she was obsessive about the detail. Like she had all these family photo albums. Then when she couldn't find albums, she'd go on like obsessively go on Google image search to try and like find the exact, you know, exact right parts of the town. And then she just became obsessed with kind of questioning her own reliability as a narrator and like going back and reading her diaries and trying to question her own accounts of events. And in the book, which they don't really try and put in the stage show, there's a lot about her diaries. And she, as a teenager, she kind of developed this obsessive compulsive streak. And she started, after every statement in her diary, she would write, "I think," in tiny letters because, you know, she wasn't sure, did it really
happen? She wrote that at the time?
No, she didn't go back and put it in afterwards. And then she developed because she was writing "I think" so much, she developed a symbol to represent "I think." And gradually these diaries become more and more obsessive until it's just giant symbols going over. And then she talks to her parents about it. I think she sees a therapist and she then manages to like row back and like kind of drop some of her obsessive behavior. But it's something that's something a bit deeper and has obviously stayed with her, is how do you recreate the truth of a situation? I guess that's what all writers are interested in.
But also, how can she recreate the truth of a situation when she doesn't know whether her father stepped in front of the bus
exactly,
or was
knocked
by it?
That's the key fact, keystone. That haunts her. And it also, there's a sense of what sort of culpability does she have in, not that she doesn't sort of go so far as to blame herself, but how much of a connection is there between her coming out and embracing all these freedoms that are on offer. When is this? It's the 70s, isn't it?
It's the 70s.
Embracing all these new freedoms and her dad seeing that and then thinking about the paths that he wasn't able to take or didn't have the courage to take.
And any natural envy he's going to have towards her there with her freedom and her openly gay with her girlfriend bringing her home to the house and everything. I was quite overwhelmed by the hype about it, and I always get really grumpy with these things, and I went along thinking like, oh, this is interesting, but it's not going to move me kind of thing. And then there was one moment when the penny dropped, which was one particular song which I believe we both liked, called "A Ring of Keys." And it's sung by the young Alison, who's Brooke Haynes, who must be all of about 11 years old. She's only been in Les Miserables, and it's stunning. It's basically a young girl singing about a lesbian adult that has walked into a diner, and the first time that she really saw an adult woman who reflected something different that she thought actually she might be. So it's a sort of love song, but to an adult. And it's performed in such a remarkable way because it's very tender and it's very shy and it's very adult. It's all full of grown-up feelings of romantic shyness in a sense, and she's just a child doing it. I mean, that you were affected by that one, weren't you?
Yeah, no, I thought that was wonderful because it was just the right mixture of childish wonder and like just the beginnings of kind of sexuality coming into it as well.
She says something like, I know this sounds conceited, but I think maybe you're like me, kind of thing.
It's just... And the key line is that the thing that really nails that song is that she's admiring like the way she wears her clothes, the way she carries herself and her ring of keys. And that's the key thing she fixates on. And I think I can really relate to, I sort of remember as a child, that's the sort of detail that you would really, you know, you'd want that, like, you know, seeing the caretaker with all their keys, you know.
That got a standing ovation when I was there for that one. It's kind of amazing. Not all the songs get claps because they're not that, you know, not that tuneful.
I don't know. Yeah, I read something, the New York Times critic was raving about the music in it and just saying that it has amazing range and it riffs on, it's kind of influenced by jazz and by Sondheim and the composer has pulled in all these different influences and turned it into something new. I really enjoyed it at the time and I felt it fit very well with the production. How memorable it is, I'm not so sure. Do you think it's political at all? Do you think it has a sort of a political value or a political message?
I think the fact that it's such a huge hit is enough there, because if you were to explain this to an audience sort of, you know, 10, 20 years ago and say that the thing that everyone's raving about is this dark story of, you know, a gay suicide and a young gay woman and, you know, and everyone's rushing to it. And the audience when I was there was like super classic, posh old London theatre audience, the ones who would go and see The Tempest if it was in the same place. And there's just no division between this being a kind of a sort of slightly off-Broadway kind of idea versus, I mean, just it just felt to me like that is mainstream theatre now in London. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
I suppose it did, in looking back at it's a kind of funny period because it's before AIDS has really blown up. So she even at one point in the book, she even thinks, well, maybe it's good that her dad did die at that time, because who knows what might have happened later. And
he goes out and picks sailors up in New York on a trip to New York, which is a very sad scene because he actually leaves the children unaccompanied in the house, nips out, locks the door and goes off cottaging. And she's very unnerved by that because she knows he shouldn't be leaving. It's the three of them and they're kind of all under the age of 12 or something.
I suppose what it does show in a political context is what a society in which kind of certain options aren't available to people, how poisonous that can be. Anyway, Fun Home is at the Young Vic until September, so you've got time, go and see it.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So, Kate, the hot new album that I'm recommending to everyone at the moment is Let's Eat Grandma and I'm All Ears. And let's hear a little bit of Hot Pink, which is a song that I heard, I think, on Stuart McConey's Freak Zone a few months ago, and it kind of was one of those that just stopped me in the middle of some mundane domestic task and had me instantly kind of...
What was your task?
Googling. It was probably emptying the dishwasher.
Emptying the cat.
There's no cat to empty, but if there was, I would empty it. It just kind of stopped me in my tracks because it starts off like a very kind of shiny Lord like pop song and then goes somewhere completely bonkers. Anyway, here's a little bit of Hot Pink. By my tongue, now that's your cue, so bring me down. Redirect your gaze, cause that's your middle name, all the same. Kill me now. I'm such a drama queen, you got something up your sleeve, don't you? So Let's Eat Grandma's Rosa Walton and Jenny Hollingworth, childhood friends.
Since the age of four.
Since the age of four, really.
Which is amazing. They met in reception. And they're from my hometown, Norwich.
Yeah. And they must be sort of... All I keep reading is that they were 17 when they released their first album, which I think must make them 18 or 19.
Yeah, they're 19 now. Right, yeah, okay. They went to Access Creative College on Magdalen Street in Norwich. The Access Colleges were only set up in the 2000s. So when I was living in Norwich, I left there in 1999. That didn't exist. But Magdalen Street was where we went on our geography field trips to count the number of closed shops in the 90s recession.
Wow.
When we did our economic studies of the sort of deconstruction of Norwich, really, and how poor it was at that point. And the other thing that Magdalen Street was famous for was that it had all the Indian restaurants on. And in that era, in the middle of the recession, there was a curry war that was famous. So you could actually get curries for £2.95 per main course because everyone was jammed up against each other and they were all competing. But now, obviously, it has a performing arts college that
does... So they wouldn't have even been born then.
They wouldn't have even been born. maybe their parents went to the NASMA brasserie that we used to go to. But yeah, so they did music degrees there and I believe they both got distinctions and then they were on the Norwich scene. And there is a great scene in Norwich because it's one of those little condensed cathedral towns with a university and a goth contingent and a skater contingent,
yeah,
and all that kind of thing. I didn't get any of that because I live 20 miles away, so you have to get the right last bus home, you know. But yeah, I do picture them sort of waiting on Castle Meadow and hanging around war memorials.
I was going to say, do you hear any Norwich in this record?
I hear Norwich in the intensity of their hobby, I suppose, that they've turned into their job, because when there's not that much to do in a place, you focus in. And I did read that they used to frequent some of the same places we did, like the waterfront and the loft, which had zebra wallpaper as far as I remember. But yeah, it's a good place for bands to start out because there are a few venues and there's not much competition. It's not like coming to London, you know. So I don't know how they were spotted, but Faris from the Horrors produced one of these songs, didn't he?
I think when I read that it made total sense because it has got his fingerprints on it a little bit. He did you ever listen to his project Cat's Eyes? Which I really like, actually, but it's kind of girl group, you know, through a kind of weird modern echo chamber. It's sort of girl group sound. And I think it chimes well with what they do. I mean, I don't really know how to describe this. It's electronic. There's synths and, you know, like I was saying, it in some ways it reminds me of things like Lord. You know, I know they listen to Frank Ocean and stuff like that, kind of modern, quite cool R&B and electronics.
There's got some very rich kind of 70s style ballads,
yes,
almost. There's a song called Ava on there, which sounds to me like if you laid that alongside a Supertramp song, it would. And I'm thinking that's kind of interesting because it's all very well to be young and talented, but to know how to structure songs like that at that age is quite impressive because that's like a perfect kind of case study of how to write a song, that one. But then I believe also, I don't know if it's that track or another one, but it turns into like a 9-minute jam. So there's that great sort of sense of experimental, random guitar stuff going on as well.
And they haven't had the corners smoothed off. I mean, I think their first album was more eccentric, but this, you know, like Hot Pink, which is the sort of the kind of lead pop record, I guess, it is a bit, it's a bit too odd for mainstream radio, isn't it? It lures you into thinking it's going to be a straight ahead pop song, and then gets quite sort of noisy, and you sense that there's something quite kind of willful about them. I imagine, I don't know how the production worked, but even though they're quite young, I imagine they probably had quite a clear idea of what they wanted.
I think they play a lot of the instruments as well. They started writing music when they were 13, and one of their early songs was called Get That Leg Off the Banister. So there's this kind of slightly weird, quirky, old soul type thing. There's some strange cliches in the titles as well. I mean, obviously the title itself, I'm All Ears, isn't something that you imagine a 19-year-old saying.
No.
And there was also a song called The Cat's Pajamas. Yeah. And no 19-year-old says that. And in a funny kind of way, that's almost gives it another level of authenticity, because it's so, because someone could have come in and said, like, that doesn't really sound like what a teenager would say. But that's what they've said. So it's fine, you know.
And I think, although I wouldn't place it as Norwich, I think you can tell it comes from outside London. It just is a bit like that Cat's Pajamas thing. It's just a little bit
cool,
off.
Cool
in a
and
good
collected
way.
Is another song. Cool and collected.
I like the lyrics. They're kind of there's lots of little glimpses of the kind of odd intensities of being, 17, 18, 19, whatever. It's not just me, is some kind of relationship. And there's a great line in that about they're having this conversation while eating peanut bagels in a foreign state. And so that's like kind of like interrailing somewhere, and they've like, they've bought a pack of bagels because they can't afford anything much more, and they're in some like little hostel or Airbnb or something, having an intense conversation about their relationship.
Those memorable kind of
maybe
trips
I'm projecting
abroad.
Too much
no,
onto
I,
that.
I thought the same with them. There's a song that there's a line like, "I feel like we're in the Everglades, running through mud." And I was like, "Did you go on holiday to the Everglades with your mum and dad at 1.5 years ago, and it left an impression?" But it's always like fascinating and lovely to hear that sort of emotional intensity about relationships from teenagers, because it's exactly what we all felt.
Yeah.
But maybe we didn't have the forum to put it out there, so it's all internalized and put into diaries and stuff, and they're just going for it.
Yeah, it's like, nicely unself-conscious.
Yeah, they call it experimental sludge pop, by the way.
Sludge pop, do they?
Which is quite nice.
Yeah.
But that sense of the messiness of it and the shoegaziness and the endless songs, you know.
Yeah, I'll buy that. How do we do a seamless segue into
there is no seamless segue apart from and another unlikely sound of the summer, but a wonderfully kind of apolitically correct unreconstructed Iggy singing about the days of when you could smoke on planes and chat up air stewards on his collaboration with Underworld, which I think is a piece of poetry.
So this is Tea Time Dub Encounters. Let's hear a little snippet of that now.
And I put down my tray table, snorted a gram of cocaine, till I got up my courage to say, "Can I have your phone number?" And she gave me the number. That was the good news. But the bad news was I got too stoned and I lost the number. The stewardess would have been better than the cocaine.
So that was the opening track, Bells and Circles, in which Iggy sort of, it's a monologue. And when it started, I thought, okay, this is Iggy being himself. But then it becomes clear it's sort of this strange persona he's taken on. And it's a sort of weird fantasy going back to thinking about the golden age of being able to smoke on airplanes. and this sort of sends him into a reverie. And there's a line in it, it's getting harder to be me.
Yes.
He keeps coming back to that.
It's getting harder to be free, getting so much harder to be me, which I just thought, and in Bells and Circles, nobody wants you to do the things that make you feel good. I mean, that kind of feels like our age, I reckon.
Yeah.
Our kind of terribly sensitive age where people like Iggy Pop are now dismissed as white men in rock rather than anything more diverse. And it's like, it feels a bit like a kind of a kick against that. I mean, maybe I'm reading that into it, but I enjoy that because I enjoy the fact that he's saying, he says that, you know, basically if the air steward's hot, then you can pick her up. So he goes like, they would open the door at the airport and you'd walk out onto the tarmac and up those stairs and light a big cigarette and stick it in the ashtray and the stewardess would come along. And if she was hot, you could try and pick her up. And that's how great it was in the past. And I just like the fact that someone's saying that.
There are, of course, good safety reasons why we can't smoke on airplanes now. But what's weird about that song as well is that he starts, I'm being way too literal on this, but he starts off by saying, if I had wings, this is what I'd do. And then the thing he'd do is smoke on an airplane. Well, if you had wings, you wouldn't necessarily need to be on the airplane. I mean, yeah, okay.
This all depends on how he writes his words, which we were wondering about, because he allegedly, for a long time anyway, did that Dadaist thing of writing a load of stuff out and then chopping it up and putting it together in a different order. I don't know. I mean, you listen to his radio show, don't you? So
yeah, he kind of, I like, I love his voice so much. And to me, this had something of the feel of his radio show, where he'll kind of be, you know, and we went into the car rental place and all of the MC5s were behind the desk at the car rental place. And they gave me a Cadillac and Patti Smith was in the back seat and I was, wow.
Well, also this suggests that this is exactly how he works, because this project only came about because Underworld found out that he was staying in the Savoy Hotel, same time as they were, and Rick Smith hired a load of his studio equipment, brought a load of his studio equipment into his hotel room, invited Iggy to come to his hotel room, and then basically put a microphone in his hand and was like, right, do something. So he had no choice at all, and he probably just knocked this out in a couple of hours, you know.
I think they were in the same place because they'd both been invited to come by Danny Boyle, because they were kind of invited to contribute to the soundtrack to Trainspotting 2. And they'd both been on, so Iggy had Lust for Life and Underworld had Born Slippy on the first Trainspotting, both really iconic. And in fact, I don't know, I think that was probably the beginning of the 90s Iggy Pop renaissance, wasn't it?
Lust for Life.
Everyone, you know, when we went to like indie clubs and stuff, like Lust for Life was a tune, would definitely be played, and it was because of that movie rather than anything else. I mean, we didn't, you know, I'm sure people much cooler than me were into the Stooges at that stage, but I didn't have vinyl copies of The Idiot or anything. I didn't really know much about Iggy Pop at all.
I like the fact that in the way the lyrics work, that there is seriousness in them. Yeah. Another line from I'll See You Big talks about demanding people, like people who are demanding. It says, people need to be demanding. I started being demanding and I lost my friends. As a demanding person, I got somewhere in life. I started having girlfriends and I was very demanding of them. I didn't let them be demanding of me.
You're not doing the voice, Kate. That's because she was so horrified when I started doing the voice. She's just decided very wisely it's not a good idea.
I enjoyed it. It's great.
It's just like, and the Underworld, it just works quite well, doesn't it? It's kind of, you know, they're not really complicated musical tracks, are they? It's just sort of thumping Underworld synths under them.
And there's a song called Get Your Shirt, which is basically just a joke and just goes, walk on!
Yeah.
And there's only four songs on this EP. It's not an album, so easy to get your head around.
Tea Time Dub Encounters. Do we know what record labels these things are on?
Grandma is Transgressive.
Okay, and Tea Time Dub Encounters is Caroline International. And they are both
labels, incidentally, known for allowing a lot of artistic freedom to their chargers.
Are you making that up?
No, it's true.
Okay.
And they're sort of good indie labels that have quite an old school heart and are quite strict about allowing artists to do what they want.
So we should support them and buy their music. I'm all ears. The Let's Eat Grandma album is out now, and Tea Time Dub Encounters is out on the 27th of July. It's time for us to celebrate the anniversary of Kate.
So I'm already singing.
You've queered her own pitch. Kate's already singing. And if you can guess it from that little snippet,
no one's going to guess it from that croaking sound.
You can skip this section. If not, Kate, what is our non-anniversary this week?
In 1997, which is how many years ago? 21?
Yeah.
This month, Save Tonight by Eagle Eye Cherry was number one in many countries. And it was the sound of the summer. Save Tonight. And then it said, like, fight the break of dawn. And it was really annoying.
Yeah, it's coming back. It's coming back to me.
It's one of those ones a bit
in
like the
high
Jose.
High definition audio.
But like the Jose Gonzalez song, where it's just an acoustic thing that just lingered for many, many, many months.
I mean, this is a real horrendous earworm. I know nothing about this guy, I must admit.
He's the half-brother of Nina Cherry, son of Don Cherry. Raised in Sweden, where Nina Cherry now lives. Sent to New York at the age of 12 to go to school, which was quite tough. He had a tough time. No, he didn't. I'm imagining that. And he was put in a performing arts school with Jennifer Aniston in his class. So wow. That could have been tough, you know.
Mixed blessing.
Yeah. And that's all. He's not famous for anything else. He had this one song. He's done lots of albums.
Do we know if he wrote it?
I don't know. Yeah. I imagine he did write it. Mm. I think what's interesting, he was focusing on his acting. And then after his father died, he went into music. So maybe that's kind of a thing. I don't know. Don Cherry was a famous jazz musician.
Mm,
and his music was very different. I looked him up. He does have new material. He is on a promo trail right now in Europe and he's looking good.
What is it about the song that makes it so irritating?
I think
it's just quite a relentless chorus.
It's
isn't
relentless.
It?
Yeah, it's like an acoustic banger.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of bleaty sound, like a goatee, like Save Tonight. And it's very rough hitting
yes,
the strings.
Yeah. Oh, stop it.
It's a proper Euro hit, you know. I imagine it on like beach parties in, you know, the late 90s with people with those tattoos of like Chinese symbols.
Yes.
Save Tonight.
Well, happy non-anniversary to Eagle Eye Cherry. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. Kate, before we go, I remembered there's one thing I wanted to say about Alison Bechdel, which is that I think for people who have never seen the book Fun Home, heard of the musical, they will have heard her name because, of course, she gave her name to the Bechdel test.
Uh-huh.
The Bechdel test being a test applied to films. Do they have at least two women in them who are named and who talk about something other than a man?
Amazing.
And what's obviously extraordinary is how many films fail.
How did that become associated with her?
She actually attributes this to a friend of hers, but she wrote a comic strip in the 80s called Dykes to Watch Out For, which is great actually. I've got a collected edition of it, and it's like a kind of long-running soap opera about, it's a medium-sized American town, I forget where it's based, it's not named, and it's like a community of, like, some of them are lesbians, some of them aren't, community of women just like getting on with their stuff and having relationships and arguments. And she wrote this into one of her strips, these two characters talking about film and saying, like, I don't go and see films unless they fulfill this criteria. And the last film I was able to go and watch was Alien. This was in like 1985. Alien had come out in 1979. So the implication is in 6 years they haven't been able to watch anything. But it's become really a really influential idea to the extent that there are now film festivals purely based on the idea of we only show films that pass the Bechdel test.
Brilliant.
So there you go. I was trying to think, does Fun Home pass the Bechdel test? But it does, of course.
It does,
because
she
has, she especially has a relationship with Joan.
The best line in the play and one of the songs, I'm changing my major to Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan with a minor in kissing Joan.
So, yes, thank you for listening. We've been edited by Caroline Crampton. Do get in touch on Twitter. I'm at Tom_Gatti, or we've got an email address, thebackhalfpodcast@gmail.com. please rate and or review us on iTunes, because that helps increase our medium-sized pool of listeners. And let's leave them with...
We will be, as ever, playing you out with the sack-grabbing Pistol Jazz and their song Godspeed.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.